see what happens. I don't think we're going to get back inside for a while.
I'll now call the meeting to order. Do we have a quorum?
Yes.
Did I poll the, we do have a quorum. Are there any public comments? Do we have anyone from the public present? There being no public comments, I believe we will move into presentations, the first of which will be Acadia. And welcome to all.
Thank you.
International equity?
Yes, emerging markets specifically.
Not developed.
Not developed.
It's tab two. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good morning.
How are you?
That's it.
Alicia?
Yes.
Is that an extra vote for the club?
I just took a picking.
First video.
Good recently experience.
Thank you.
Good morning. Sitting, Christopher.
Need a couple of those?
Thank you, Matt. Thank you.
So about a 20-minute presentation and then a little bit of time for questions afterwards.
Sure.
Great.
So go ahead and get started.
Good morning, everybody. Again, thank you for having us in. I'm Chris Toko, Scott Brimer next to me here. We'll take about 20 minutes, and hopefully within that time we'll cover everything about Acadian from an organizational standpoint, as well as the business and investment performance-related side as well. So we're pleased to be here, and pleased to have you as a client, now going on the seventh year, so thank you for your support. I'll update you a little bit on Acadian as a firm, the short version being not a whole lot has changed from a structural standpoint. Clearly, since we've met last in person the past few years, the firm has continued to develop. Mostly good news, actually all good news, I would say. Page 7 in the presentation book will give a high-level overview. So we celebrated our 30th year in business, so we're about 32 years now as a firm. Very much still the same firm we were when we were founded, which is a systematic manager managing international and emerging markets equities. So it's very much our bread and butter, what we still continue to do. Scott and I both came out of our Boston office. It's where most of our investment professionals still are today. That said, we have 4 overseas offices. Each of those offices have both business as well as investment professionals. Everybody ultimately reports into the Boston office. You can see the pie chart on the bottom of that page, which just gives a representation of our asset pool. About $100 billion in total assets under management. Diverse set of strategies, emerging markets. You can see represented in the top left quadrant of that pie chart, so something we have a strong footprint in. We've been doing since the early 90s, so we were fairly early to invest in emerging markets on behalf of our clients. Definitely early as a quantitative manager. Just as diverse as our product makeup is, our client set is quite diverse as well. Public funds, still a big part of our business. In fact, a majority of our business continue to be local municipality and public funds. So we very much appreciate working with you all, understand your mission, and ultimately our goal is to provide for your beneficiaries. A bit of an update since we last met. One thing I would report would be a successful succession plan at Acadian. So we have The firm, I mentioned, a little over 30 years old. Since we last met, Churchill Franklin, who was one of the co-founders of the firm, was the CEO when we last met. Effective January 1st, so just this January, Churchill became the chairman and relinquished his role as CEO. It was a five-year planned structure in place for Churchill. So two internal members became co-CEOs of the firm, John Chisholm, our existing co-CIO, and Ross Dowd, who had led our global client group for over 10 years. Again, Churchill remains with the firm in the chairman role, which is a key role. He's really one of the culture carriers of the firm that all of us kind of look up to. One notable departure we've had more recently would be Maurizio Karchmer. Maurizio was the head of our trading systems, essentially. So Maurizio left in December. He's got a team of about 16 people that had worked underneath him. What we've got right now is a committee in place to continue to lead the efforts of our trading and implementation team. So nothing changes at the firm day to day. You know, that said, we do plan to announce in time his successor. One touch on capacity, which is something Acadian has been a hallmark in being very conservative as far as closing strategies at appropriate levels. That way we preserve value added for our existing clients. Emerging markets, clearly one of the strategies that is most capacity constrained for us and has been closed for a number of years still. So where we're at right now, you can see the footprint, a little over $20 billion in assets. We are trying to manage outflows with inflows, where we've seen outflows either due to pensions de-risking, so taking equities off the table, rebalancings, as emerging markets had quite an incredible run last year. We have seen a lot of our pension plans rebalancing away from emerging markets into domestic, into fixed income, those sorts of things. So we'll continue to see flows at that level, but we're not broadly open for public searches at this point in time, again, based on capacity to remain able to add value for clients. So let me stop there before I use up too much time. Happy to take any questions if helpful at this point. No? Okay. Good. Maybe just an update on page 8. This is the investment team structure. Where Scott sits in this schematic would be on the portfolio management team, so right in the middle at the bottom. So all in, I mentioned, sizable firm, about 100 investment professionals. So you can see this structure allows a large investment team to be somewhat nimble. So the portfolio manager at Acadian is a little different than more of a traditional shop where they're actually talking to companies, picking stocks and bonds. What we do is, again, a systematic approach. So we trust our model. We believe that we're victims of behavioral finance. We make decisions, we make mistakes, so we expect that we want to try to take ourselves out of that potential to make investment mistakes. So we follow our model. So Scott's job on the portfolio management, definitely we want to review portfolios before we put trades out. So there are various different roles, but I would just typify his as a little bit different than the traditional portfolio manager, just for some backdrop. So with that, I'll turn it over to Scott. Maybe we can give you a refresher on what we do, how we do it, and then we'll clearly talk through performance and portfolio positioning.
Absolutely. Well, thanks, Chris, and thank you all for your time today. Maybe before we speak about performance results, maybe just a few minutes on our investment process. And I'm happy to answer any questions as we go along here. Maybe beginning on page 12, if you would, of the performance of the presentation materials. So as Chris mentioned a few times, we manage what we call a systematic process, right? So we're very quantitative in nature, a quantitative investment approach, but it's one that's deeply rooted in fundamentals, right? So if you think about kind of the way we view the world as quants versus kind of your traditional bottom-up stock picker type of manager, philosophically we're close to the bottom-up traditional manager. We just do things in a very systematic, objective, repeatable way. So basically what we do is on a daily basis evaluate tens of thousands of stocks around the world. You'll see here on page 12, in fact, we cover over 13,000 stocks in emerging markets. And we basically evaluate stocks relative to their peers across 21 characteristics, what we call factors. Those factors or characteristics are grouped broadly into four groups: value, quality, growth, technical. So think about valuation as things like price to earnings, price to book, free cash flow yield, quality factors. We look at, you know, how are companies improving their profitability? Do they have strong, we look at certain measures of strength of balance sheets, of reported earnings. And then a number of growth and more technical type of factors, right? So our companies showing, you know, strong growth in earnings per share, some momentum type of signals that the companies have price support in the market. So think about, you know, a very much multi-factor approach to stock selection. So getting, basically building well-diversified, risk-controlled portfolios full of companies that are, again, have quality financial statements, that trade at a relative discount to their peers on certain valuation metrics, but have attractive growth and price characteristics as well. So think about, you know, cheap, high-quality stocks that have a catalyst behind them, broadly speaking. So that's basically that's kind of the model that Chris talked about. This is all quantitatively done, so we take in a lot of data on a daily basis, kind of have stock return forecasts for every stock in the universe, that we build, again, a well-diversified risk control portfolio using those metrics. So as we talk about performance today, you know, we'll talk about what impact did those four factor groups have on our returns. Did our value characteristics do well? Did growth or momentum do well?
And how do you integrate, ESG? Yes. Into it? I mean, I see that listed here.
Yeah, so there are a number of different factors that, those 21 characteristics or factors that we talked about that have an ESG component to them. One that I would point out is a governance factor, the G in the ESG. One of our quality factors is basically a forensic accounting measure, where we have a third-party forensic accounting firm that ranks all these stocks. And we take it in and make it a quantitative signal in our model. So that would be an example of one. There are a couple other ones on the ENS side as well. So very systematic in everything that we do, really. There's a bottom-up and a top-down view. So I talked about the fact that we evaluate every company across these 21 characteristics relative to their peers. We do a similar thing where we evaluate every emerging markets country relative to their peer. So we have a country view and a kind of bottom-up stock view that we combine into that one single stock return forecast. Portfolio construction is very disciplined as well. So basically we're using what we call an optimizer to build a portfolio that gets, you know, deep exposure to these return forecasts, but incorporates a number of risk controls into the process as well. So controlling the amount of small size risk that we have, data exposure, country industry exposures, etc. So it's kind of a very high-level view of the process. Any questions that we can address on that before we discuss results? Okay, so why don't we go to page 22, please. So here's the performance of your investment, both gross and net of management fees, since inception. Inception was November of 2011. So a fairly deep track record here with your investment. We thank you for that. The benchmark here, of course, is MSCI's Emerging Markets Index. This is a dedicated emerging markets portfolio. We are always fully invested. So you'll notice as we go through here, the cash balance is about 0.3%. So we're not attempting to time the market either through cash balances or low or high beta exposure. So think of our approach as fully invested in a dedicated fashion to emerging markets, where our value added will be stock selection within countries and within industries. So we're not, another way of saying we're not taking large market timing bets in any fashion. For 2017, as you know, markets very strong. So the benchmark was up over 37%. You can see there kind of in the center of the graphic. We're able to add, you know, some moderate active performance on top of that very strong benchmark return. So about 150 basis points on top of the 37%. And again, we did that in a kind of beta neutral, fully invested approach. And so not a bet on higher risk stocks that outperform. Again, you know, good risk adjusted stock selection, which is kind of going to be our bread and butter. I talked about those four factor groups, value, quality, growth, technical factors. What really, it was really a period where taking that multi-factor approach was beneficial for us. So if you think about Acadian, those value groups of factors are influential in our process. Think about 50% of our return forecast come from that value component. 2017 was a period where value, generally speaking, did not perform well. So we had some headwinds from having those cheaper priced stocks relative to their peers. But it was an environment where growth and technical factors did very, very well. So having exposure to those characteristics allowed us to outperform the market in a sharply higher market environment. The longer term view, so let me show you the 5-year number there. The market up just over 4% over the trailing 5-year period. We've been able to add about 130 basis points on top of that on a gross of management fee basis. So again, strong performance in an environment where typically, you know, generally speaking, those valuation characteristics that we rely pretty heavily upon had, you know, below historical average payoffs. And again, exposure to quality, growth, and technical characteristics allowed us to add some value on top of the index there.
And then if you look at the second to last line on this page, it shows the 6.9 relative to 5%. So that since you've invested in this strategy in 2011, we've added just shy of 2% annualized in excess return. And then the last line, that 15.6 figure versus 15.3, that's the risk of the portfolio. So we've added about 2% annualized since inception while taking about the same level of risk as the capitalization rate of that MSCI Emerging Markets Benchmark. So again, that's a proof statement that we're not taking outsized bets in the portfolio, and then we can obviously speak to the positioning of the portfolio if that's helpful to show what a classic Acadian portfolio would look like.
How many companies are in our portfolio?
So there are over 700. So maybe turn to page 18 and we'll discuss that. So so there are 738 stocks as of the end of December. And think about, so what we're doing is, again, building very diversified portfolios to get exposure to these 21 characteristics. But doing it by taking small individual positions across a large number of companies. Right, so basically, we want to spread out the individual stock-specific risk and have these characteristics drive our performance. That being said, the portfolios remain very active. Right, so very well diversified, but still very active. If you were to think about a measure that we call active share. So how much turnover would be required to move the portfolio as it is today to the benchmark? That would require 70% turnover. So very diversified, but very, very active funds as well. Then on page 18, we show you some of the key valuation characteristics for the portfolio relative to the benchmark. I talked about this idea that value factors are important in our process here, looking at things like price to earnings, price to book, price to sales. You can see that the portfolio is traded at a deep discount versus the index. So price to earnings ratio of 10.1 versus 15 for the index. If you were to think about that, the price to earnings for a broader MSCI World type of index, it's trading at close to 20 times earnings. So again, building a portfolio of very attractively priced stocks that have a number of these other attractive characteristics to go along with that. In the bottom left, the cap size, the portfolios will tilt somewhat small relative to the benchmark. You can see about almost a 5% overweight to that smallest group of stocks. Those with a market cap below $1.5 billion. And that's not a view from us that we think small cap stocks will systematically outperform large, but rather that we know that we have pronounced skill within those less efficiently priced smaller companies. So we'll allow the portfolio some exposure, some active exposure relative to the index there, but do it again in a very risk-controlled way as we build the portfolio. So I think we'll have a few more minutes. So maybe pages 19 and 20, very quickly, we show you the portfolio's positioning across regions and countries. as we construct your portfolio, we do it in a way where we want to allow ourselves some active exposure to countries and industries, but not too much. So think about benchmark plus or minus 5% across countries and across industry groups. So we want to take some region, let's say an industry exposure, to allow ourselves to express those top-down views in the portfolios, but do it, again, trading off expected returns with expected risk in really in all aspects of our portfolio construction.
Do you stress test the portfolio for different sort of market impacts to sort of see what would happen with that? And is commodities part of that? Like, sort of, you know, everybody always talks about the link of emerging markets to commodity prices, and sort of how do you...
Yeah, so commodity price is a component of our top-down model. So I talked about the fact that we have this top-down emerging markets model where we predict or we kind of rank, if you will, the attractiveness of one country relative to another. Commodity price impact is one of the factors that goes into the top-down model. So companies, for example, that have a greater share of their GDP coming from exports of commodities will measure the changes in those prices and how the sensitivity we think. So for example, companies that are big exporters of metals and mining, as those prices rise, it will be a positive score to our top-down model, and we'd shift the portfolio's margin towards those countries. Stress testing, so as we, in our portfolio construction, we use a number of different risk models. Certainly commodity price impact would be a factor in those risk models. So certainly we view risk in a multi-dimensional way using various risk measures and risk models. Finally, maybe on page 21, the top 10 holdings in the fund as of the end of December. I think the key takeaway here is the fact I mentioned a moment ago that we do, build well-diversified portfolios, lots of stocks, but small individual position sizes. So as Chris mentioned, everything is very systematic. So it's not we as PMs and analysts saying, we think... this company XYZ has a big hit in their new product. Let's put 10% of the fund into that company. Well diversified, spread out bets that trying to get exposure to these characteristics that we think are predictive. I talked about the active share. So you see that at the very bottom, 68%. So measure of activity relative to the index. Again, very diversified, very active portfolios with small individual position sizes. You can see in that grid there.
What's the return for the portfolio through Friday? Do you know what year to date, how you've done?
Yeah, so obviously volatility has returned. So the markets were sharply higher in January, so continuing the trend that we saw in 2017. MSCI's emerging markets index was up over 8% in January. Your fund was about in line, so pretty much flat on an active return basis. The market has given back all of that and a little bit more. So MSCI's emerging market is down about 9% so far in February. And again, on an active basis, we've added, I think, about 50 basis points. So absolute return, down 1%, active, up about 50 basis points. The actual return forecasting model has done okay through that period. I talked about the fact that the payoffs to our valuation type of factors have been on the low side over the past number of years. We've seen some positive payoffs to value, and indeed to our quality factors as well in the market downturn, as you'd expect. So as the market sells off, investors typically tend to pay more attention to fundamentals, things like valuation metrics, quality metrics, and that's been a source of positive performance during the sell-off for us.
Do you want to say anything about the markets? And maybe you have any crystal ball in your search thoughts going forward?
I don't have a computer in yours.
I didn't bring it.
I'm a shot too.
So what I would say is we continue to find emerging markets to be a very attractive asset class relative to developed markets. On that characteristics page, I pointed to the price-to-earnings ratio of the index about 15 times. MSCI World, almost 20 times. The U.S. even more expensive, over 20 times. The S&P 500, So from a valuation perspective, emerging markets looks attractive, and historically so. Right? So if you look at those relationships through time, EM is trading at even a deeper discount relative to DM than it has in the past. So we think it looks attractive. We continue to think we have a lot of ability to add active returns in EM. That all being said, emerging markets in sharp downturns tend to have a higher beta relative to DM. So if the market sells off in an OH fashion, EM tends to sell off more. We don't think that that scenario will take place. We think a lot of what happened over the past number of days, there was some technical component to it. We don't anticipate a big 2008 type event. If that is true, and we see kind of a regular type of correction, we think emerging markets, given their valuation discount, are positioned to outperform developed markets over the coming intermediate future here.
The posture of the portfolio, given that we do spread things out so widely, not only with stocks, but also, you know, characteristics, different risk measures, that sort of thing, there should not be one embedded risk that would kind of haunt the portfolio and cause any undue stress relative to the benchmark. We might be plus or minus, give or take, but there should not be any major upset. And in fact, the goal of this portfolio is to outperform between 2-3% annualized over a market cycle, which is right where we're at today. Any other thoughts or questions we can address today?
There being none, gentlemen, we thank you very much for visiting with us today.
Great. Thank you. Thanks again for your loyalty. We appreciate the time this morning.
Bond bill.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you all.
Want to pass it
down? Yeah. Okay.
Thank you. All right, I think I'm up.
You're up.
All right, time for the annual valuation report. I'll let you guys get these things fired up. It's 1111.
5000,
that's
in March.
Pretty close. Pretty close.
Close. My hacking skills are subpar, clearly. Yeah. I needed a teenager to help me out.
Okay, page 5 shows the city's contribution requirements.
You would give me one, Doug, but just give
me one. Switch with that one, yeah. And then just grab this, I'll take care of it.
There we go. Thank you.
Couldn't be operated.
Okay, not a big change in dollar. It did go up a bit since the last valuation, but that has more to do with assumption changes. You remember we went through the exercise of updating the experience study last year, and I gave those results in May. And so this report fully incorporates all of those assumption changes. So you see the dollar funding requirement for the city for the current year is the right-hand column, and that's $15,254,002. And for next fiscal year for budgeting, it's gone up a little bit to $15,338,996. So even with the changes in assumptions, there was unfavorable experience this last year in total. That's one of the reasons we decided to change some assumptions, aside from the fact that the ordinance requires that we go through the experience study update every 5 years. And the fact is, there was low turnover, and you had more retirements than expected. I think it's kind of a broken record. We keep getting more and more retirements every year, more than expected. So the experience study, I think, should help take care of that going forward. There's no promises. That's why you have to see the actuary every year. We have to measure what was expected versus what happened. So low turnover and more than expected retirements. The investment assumption, though, you beat that. Remember, you've had 7% net since the plan closed. And the five-year average this year came in at 7.93. So you did book an actuarial gain on that side. If you jump over to page 8, just to show you that there still is some prior investment gains that will be recognized over the next 5 years in total. And the way you can tell that every year is just look under item B, assets. And the actuarial value is the five-year smooth that we're using, and that's $142.6 million with this rounding. And the market value, the fair market value, no smoothing, is 143.8. So that means there's still about $600,000 or $700,000 of prior investment gains yet to flow into the plan. So that will help out. If you jump over to page 9, even with the change in assumptions and the net loss for the year, the funded status did improve. A year ago it was 59.1, it's now 62.5. If we didn't make any assumption changes, it would have been 63, so the assumption changes really didn't have a big change in the funded status. Let's talk about the assumption changes that we made, just as a reminder. If you flip back to 7, and the 5 items you see listed below, we'll just go through them very quickly. Salary increases, we changed. Number 2, we changed mortality. We didn't have any say-so, the state told us to. Well, they didn't write a letter to Ocala, but state law. You whatever Florida retirement system, yeah, whatever Florida retirement system assumes, you guys have to assume. Number 3, withdrawal rates. We dramatically lowered those. So remember, I just said we had turnover loss this year. Going forward, it's going to be easier to not have a loss, easier to have a gain, because now we're assuming low turnover. Number 4, we changed early retirement. It used to be a flat 2%. We realized that was woefully low, although at this point in the game, there may be so few people eligible for early retirement that it may not have a big impact going forward, but we did change the early retirement rates. We upped them. And number 5, we changed the rates of normal retirement. Okay? So if you want to see the impact on city funding with and without the assumption changes, if you go to page 11, there wasn't a whole lot of change. The middle column shows that had we made no assumption changes, the city's funding requirement would have stayed almost exactly the same as last year. It would have gone up $4,000. But incorporation of the assumptions, you move from the middle to the left-hand column, and that costs about $70,000 a year or so. So not a big change. And so where I want to finish up, and then turn it over to you if you have any questions, is to remind everybody that the city's funding is going to start dropping pretty quickly for this plan. I think you've all been anticipating this. If you jump over to page 14, I've been reminding everybody for a couple of years that we're getting close. And if you look on this page, remember this is the unfunded liability, and it's comprised of a whole schedule at the bottom, which actually extends to the next page. And so the items of interest are the ones with years remaining that are very low, like 1. So if you jump down to that, that's an actuarial loss from 10 years ago. And we know about that, the market in 2008. The remaining payment for that is $1.4 million plus interest. And when I'm here next year at this time, I can't tell you what the city's requirement would be or would have been. But I can tell you, whatever number I report, it's going to be $1.4 million plus interest lower. And then another big one, the following year, actuarial loss in 2009, is $3.3 million plus interest. So when I'm here in 2 years, whatever the city's requirement would have been, which again will be 1.4 plus interest lower going into that year, 3.3 plus interest falls off. So I wouldn't be surprised that when I'm here at this meeting in February of, believe it or not, 2020, 2 years, that the city's requirement may very well be below $10 million, where right now it's over 15. So you can continue this exercise on your own.
Can we all just take a phrase break? The budget director wants to take a phrase break on that.
Now, you may be thinking ahead a little bit, so I've anticipated that thought. It's, the corridor test, we're about to get good news. And I can't tell you if that's true or not, because the corridor test is based on projections that the city's actuary ran just before the plan changed. And those projections already knew that these pieces were falling off. So if you somehow find those projections that were provided to the city when the plan closed, it ran out, it showed a graph that was starting to come down in the next couple of years anyways, and that the corridor is based on that. So remember, we've not only had unfavorable experience due a lot to retirements in the last couple of years, we had to change those assumptions. So those projections are based on old assumptions. We had to change assumptions primarily for retirement and mortality. The mandated mortality was not included in those projections. There was, but it wasn't the exact mortality we're using now. So we're going to have to keep running the corridor test every year. And I can't tell you right now if we're going to keep bumping up against the upper limit or whether we start to fall back inside. Okay, but good news is the city requirements are going to start coming down pretty fast the next couple of years. So that's it. Happy to answer questions if you got them.
Yeah, just as a reminder for the group on those corridors, on the way down, back to the base assumptions, the employee contributions affected first, so we went from 3 to 5, if you'll recall, most recently. We would go, you know, from 5 to 3, and if we were still outside the corridor, then we would start to do increase in multiplier. So it's the other direction, you know, we would go.
Yeah. When does that change? At what point?
It will change at the point in time in which we are outside the corridors to the good.
Yeah.
So it'll be a hot minute before we get there, because okay. We have to stay in those parameters. We were, what, point something outside this time. Like
you're like the left-hand side of the road. Think of the corridor as a road. You're outside to the bad right now.
We need to be in the middle towards the right to start to see the assumptions go down.
It's got to go back to council once that happens.
Yes, it would go back to council. And it won't necessarily go 5.3. It might go from 5 to 4.26 to 3.18. So, you know, it'll do whatever it does to get within that corridor. Mm-hmm. And then once we get all the way to 3 on the employee side, then we would start to up the multiplier on the other side. From the 1 to
back to 10-1-13, I forget the exact date, but it'll be retro.
Right, back to that date. So then we recalculate that part A of that check and you know, all that good stuff. So, and I know from the employee perspective, like, we understand why this is all great and the unfunded and, you know, all that kind of stuff, and the city writing a smaller check to fund the plan. And but the few employees that are left in this plan, all they want to know is when can I get to pay 3 again, so
yeah.
Even though it's their money for their retirement going to them. So, I mean, you're going to get 100% of that back, so let's see.
How many employees are actually in this plan?
192.
It is 214
as of that's as of October.
Yeah, so there's less now.
Yeah. We're right hovering right around 200.
Yeah, we might have all of them numbers. Yeah, and this people have left since then, so it is right around 200 now.
There is some help to getting back to the corridor in spite of the assumption changes, and that's when we changed to dollar funding.
Yes.
That dollar funding does aggressively pay down the unfunded. faster than percent of payroll. So that is an offsetting help to getting us back in the corridor.
If there are no further questions of the actuary, we will move on to our next presenter or consultant. Thank you, Mr. Lewis.
Would you guys like to?
Do we have to accept the motion if it's
acceptable?
I would entertain a motion to accept the actuarial report.
Second.
We have a motion from Ms. Carroll. Do we have a second? We have a second from Mr. Ortiz. All in favor?
All right. Thank you.
Aye.
Okay, Bernie, now having done that, as we've done the last several years, the board will need to determine by motion the total expected annual return for the current year, the next several years, and the long term thereafter. And then that goes in correspondence to the division, copy to Doug, and a copy to the city.
Lee, I tried to follow you there.
Okay.
We need to be specific now in a motion with regard
to... Yeah, and this is not the actual assumption. This is what you actually expect to return over the three time periods, near-term, intermediate, long-term, based on Rose's and Doug's recommendation.
And so typically we'll write you a letter after
okay,
you get that
motion, say,
and that
we're
goes,
get those numbers
and that
and
goes to the
it.
Division,
yeah.
But your current asset allocation is set up to achieve, over the short term and long term, 7%.
Do I entertain that motion today, or is that time
today?
If we get, okay. Would someone care to make that motion, or can we... just incorporate what our attorney just said we needed to do.
We can incorporate.
Would anyone care to make a motion incorporating what Attorney Diener has told us needs to be provided to the state with regard to the compliance of the plan? Do I hear a motion?
I'll make a motion that we approve the short and long term rate at 7%.
Do I have a second?
A second.
We have a second from Mr. Ortiz. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
The motion passed.
Okay, now Doug is required by statute to do additional calculations, and they need to be filed electronically with the division with a hard copy to the board within 60 days. I believe he's going to do that. And then Rose has to provide, there's an administrative rule part of 60T. Rose needs to provide information from 60T within 60 days as well.
And I will actually do the letter to the division.
Yep. How about that to Alicia then?
I would tell you that does not require a motion. That is to be spread upon the minutes and acted upon. Mm-hmm. Rose, you are next then.
Sounds great. So everybody should have my book in front of you. So you can always go through this on a quarterly basis. So they'll just start in and look at the markets. So we're under tab one, page one. I will note that as you heard the presenter present, you know, we've had a rocky couple weeks with the market. So the S&P through Friday was down 2.02%. I have a supplement I'll pass out here shortly to talk a little bit about the recent markets, but the market was up almost 6% S&P in January, and then we had a lot of pullback. I will remind folks that this did happen in the beginning of 2016. We came out to a real rough start in 2016 with negative markets, and we were able to, sort of pull out of that. I can't predict what the markets will do, you know, we sort of, given the levels of the markets, we sort of expected this at some level that we would see some pullback at some time. And we can talk more about that as you get into this. But through the fourth quarter, we had really strong markets. World equities was up 5.5% through December, 22% for the year. Emerging markets, which you just heard a presenter, up 7% for the quarter, up 37% for the 1 year period ending December. International markets outperformed domestic markets. That hadn't always been the case up until about a year ago or so. The U.S. markets were sort of crushing international markets, so we sort of saw a return to that a little bit. Fixed income was basically flat for the quarter, 3.5% for the year period. International markets was up 10% for the year, up 1.6% for the quarter. Commodities actually had a positive quarter, not so much for the year, 1.7% positive. Real estate did well, private equity did well, hedge funds did well. Our research department sort of noted, I mean, you had a year in 2017 where everything was positive. I mean, that's not normally the case. So, really, really sort of interesting times we're in. Page two, you can sort of see that in more actual, you know, numbers there. And you can see what we talked about is the U.S. versus non-U.S. On the 10-year number, you still see a very big difference between what U.S. stocks have done over the last 10 years versus non-U.S. stocks, right? So you're seeing a little bit comeback of this non-U.S. market, you know, sort of trying to come back, getting closer to where the U.S. markets have been. For stocks, commodities still negative on the 10-year number there. And fixed income, when we did your last asset allocation, it'll probably be due to do another asset allocation for you at the end of this year. We predicted bonds to be about 4%, and that's about what they are on the 10-year number. So these charts are basically the same from quarter to quarter. We'll look a little bit at the fixed income markets on page 9. You can sort of see the yield curve here. The yield curve flattened in the fourth quarter. Short-term yields rose significantly, while long-term rates modestly declined. And a lot of people are talking about the link of the yield curve with what happened in the markets in the last 2 weeks. I have some supplemental slides to sort of talk a little bit about that. But you really see a big bump up. We hadn't seen that on the short level of a bump up in rates on the short side. And people were getting nothing for so long. I'm just so used to sort of seeing that bump up. We always talk a little bit about noteworthy developments. So that's pages 17, 18, and 19. And again, yield curve as an indicator of recession. So that sort of shows you about this yield curve and where those points have happened. So that's an interesting one to look at. On the next page, page 18, a lot of people, when these markets happen, people are like, well, we should get out of equities. It's been such a high run, and we've made a lot of, we let them hedge the portfolio or take it out. Well, this really shows that if you missed, and this is a long time period, right? So this is from 1980 to 2017. If you missed the best 10 days in the market, your return went from 13% to 9%. That's just 10 days in like a 30-year period, a 40-year period. If you missed the 20 best days, and then if you missed the 30 best days, look at what that does. You go from 13% to 6%. So that's really what we tell you. It's important to rebalance your portfolio as markets rise, but to make dramatic changes can really, market timing, you know, just is one of the most difficult things to do in investing, and you typically end up getting whipsawed for that. Page 19 talks a little bit about growth versus value in emerging markets. He talked a little bit about that there, but you can see how last year value was outperforming growth. This year growth significantly outperformed value. So you can see we really have a core position, and the reason you do that, you can't really predict when value or growth will outperform. So we'll just get into your performance, which is under tab 2, and look at page page 24. It's not really labeled, but it's your target versus actual there that we'd like to go over. So on the left-hand side, so this all, sometimes, it, you know, I just like to remind boards that this page really ties into your policy guidelines. So you have guidelines that govern your plan, and so this page ties into your governance, right? So the left-hand side is what your targets are supposed to be, and then the right-hand side is where they are. And we review this every quarter because as the markets do better in one area, you want to rebalance a little bit. So you can see your large cap target's at 14 and you're at 16. Your small cap target's at 6 and you're at 7. Your international target's at 22 and you're at 23.81. And so your equity target's at 42 and you're at 47. So you're about 5% over there in the market. But you're not outside any of your ranges. You can see up there with your range for large cap, your range for small cap, and international. So you're not outside, you know, outside your ranges. On fixed income, your target's 32 and you're at 28.3, so a little bit under there. Real estate, your target's at 12.5 and you're at 11.21. And so you have committed some more money to real estate, so that money will be called down and that'll be pulled from the places where you're over allocated. And then alternatives, your target's 13.5 and you're at 12.46. And then you do have a little bit of cash. And Alicia let me know that you're going to have a little bit more cash coming in. So what we'll do is when we get that cash, we'll put it in the places where you're under allocated, and that'll help bring it closer to your targets.
Here's a quick question. Where do we come up with these targets?
So what we do for you every 3 to 4 years, and I sort of mentioned that we'll probably do one at the end of this year, is we do an asset allocation study, which I come in and I say, okay, if you have this mix, this mix, this mix, this is the return that it gets. So that sort of ties into the 7% I talked about with Doug's. So I say, if you have this mix, you're going to get 7.25. If you have this mix, you'll get 7.5. If you get this mix, you'll get 6.5. Like what? And then I'll show the risk level for those mixes, and you'll be like, okay, we're comfortable with this risk level, we're not comfortable with that, and you'll pick a mix.
Okay.
And so these were picked, and then every 3 or 4 years, you do another one and say, are we still comfortable with our mix, or do we want to change it a little bit? And then we change your guidelines to reflect it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's fine.
So the next page, page 25, is just your fees. So luckily to say, in this world of money managers making lots of money, we have pushed down fees, you know, as much as we can. You know, you don't see many managers here above the 1%, you know, range there. We try to keep it that way. You know, when we regularly go back to managers to try to push down the fees. On some of the real estate funds, you're going to have a little bit of a higher fee because they are, it's a little bit more of a labor-intensive process to go out and find buildings to develop. But on a net of fee basis, they've all done very, very well for you. And then we'll get into your performance. So we'll just go all the way to page 30, because we like to do the performance for the total fund and then your managers. So for the quarter, you were up 3.08%, a little bit below your policy index, but that's a great start to your fiscal year, right? So, you know, because your fiscal year ends in September, you know, it starts. So that's a good start. You know, you got to get your 7% to have a 3% starting point is really good. You know, because we don't know what the first quarter will do given that, you know, we're a little bit negative territory here. But year to date, 14.46 versus your benchmark of 13.95. So really strong trailing 12 months. A little bit under on the 3 year, outperforming 5 year, really in line on the 7 year, 10 year, and outperforming since inception. Doug, and maybe his information goes back more than 2000, but you know our information just goes back to 2000. Wedge Capital doing well for you, outperforming overall periods. So you had them almost now for over 10 years, and they've done very well for you. Wellington, they're more recent. They do have 5 years of history with you now. They had a tough quarter there, and one-year period, and 3 and 5. So that's somebody that we've been watching. That may be somebody we want to bring in to the next meeting to talk to, and we'll continue to look at them. When you look at the year-by-year numbers for them, you know, they've had more years where they outperform than underperform. We'll continue to watch them. Wellington's a very strong firm. We like them. The fundamentals over there are good. I think when I looked up their performance for the quarter, information technology, healthcare, and consumer discretionary were some of the areas where they lagged. Siegel Bryant Hamill has done well, outperforming for the quarter in the one-year period. Still lagging a little bit on the 3 and 5 year and since inception, but they got off to like a little bit of a rocky start, but they're making a lot of that back here. Templeton is the manager, and they don't have a perfect benchmark because they're, you know, because your portfolio is a little bit smaller, we try to have one international development manager that has everything in it. And because of that, they're not a pure ACWI, which is the second benchmark, but they're not a pure EFI manager. So we look at them over time. Since inception, they've outperformed. But here a little bit, they've had trouble keeping up with the 25% market here in the more recent period. Again, out of all your managers, those are the two that we're going to keep watching. And if we need to, you know, swap them out, we will. But they've been consistent performers for you over time. Acadian, you had in today, underperformed a little bit for the quarter, but outperforming overall periods. They've done very, very well for you. Pyramus, outperforming overall periods, done very well. Double Line underperformed slightly for the quarter, but outperforming overall other periods. UBS Realty, we brought them in, we talked to them, outperforming for the quarter, but, you know, some of the longer-term numbers since inception outperforming, but the 3-5 year was under. And we talked to them, and it really has a lot to do with the leverage that they use versus the benchmark. They're a little bit more conservative of a manager than some other real estate managers, but still really strong returns for you. The core space has been a little bit of a difficult place to be. Wellington, if you remember, you hired them to replace PIMCO, who you had for a long time, and they've done fabulous. They're doing really well, and they're a little bit under-allocated, so when we get that extra money in and we invest that cash, we'll give them some of that money. Atos, you know, sort of after a while and sort of trimming them back a little bit, they're doing a lot better, 7% versus a benchmark of 5.9, under a little bit for the quarter. But if you look at their five-year number at the 537 versus Pyramus of the 341, that's what you really hired them to do. You hired them to get a couple more percent than bonds. And so they did do that over the five-year period. We'd like a little bit more than that, so we're sticking with them there, you know, seeing that, especially with this volatility, hoping that that'll get a little bit more there for them. And then your cash funds there. And then the only other, page 32, is your closed-end managers. They're measured on an IRR basis versus a time-weighted basis. And you really just look at the since inception IRR for these managers. You've developed a private real estate program. You didn't have one. You just had really UBS doing your real estate. We really felt like you needed a diversified real estate portfolio, not just core real estate and core markets. This is what you've developed over the years. It has done very well for you. If you look at the total of the since inception of 10.86%, each of those managers have done well. The more recent ones haven't had time to develop those buildings. That's why you see the 5 and the 1.52. But just they've done very well for you. Both Penn Square, which Town Square, you know, you did Penn and then you did the Town Square. That was their next fund. They're going to have another fund out, so that'll be something we'll do either at the next meeting or the meeting after to look at, you know, have them do a review of their funds, but look at their newer fund. And also Long Wharf is going to have, towards the end of the year, another fund out there, so that'll be something that you'll need to look at. And that's basically it for the performance. I'll take any questions. I was just going to pass out this market update just...
Yep.
Everybody get one?
Rose, I'll take one.
Got it.
You got one?
Yep.
So, we just put these together, you know, people have been asking us about the markets and what's been happening in the markets, and so page one just talks about volatility. We've actually had, 2017 was the lowest volatility year. You know, there's some very little volatility in the market. So I guess we're due for some volatility, which is what we've seen in the last couple weeks, but that's sort of what this just shows. It has been as high as 85 in 2008, but just, you know, sort of look just from 14 to 18, just 4 years, you know, just very low volatility in the markets. The next page, page two, just shows you the dispersion in 17, right? So with this low volatility, but you've seen significant variability of returns across the different sectors, right? So between energy and the best performing healthcare, it's a 53% difference. So it really mattered what you were investing in and how that did. So people who wanted you to invest in those sector funds may have taken a little more risk than they needed to take. Page three, so this is PE ratios. Everybody always talks about PE ratios, so price of a stock versus their earnings. They're above median over all markets except Japan, and so you know, is that going to lead to volatility and sort of talk about that. So that's interesting. This page is sort of, on November 28th, this was when North Korea launched their ballistic missile. So you would think that all the markets would be negative, right? So they were. All the markets were a positive, and not only positive up a percent, up a lot. In the past, that would, you know, that would have caused markets to be negative. So we did a lot of research on what happened that day to see if we could find something that that can, you know, contributed to this. Jay-Z got nominated for a lot of awards this day. Yeah, and then also the royal wedding was announced this day. So maybe that's what's moving the market. Right. So. So, you know, so is that the new normal? We're not sure, but it's, you know. Page five, this is sort of really talking about, are investors still concerned with inflation, path of interest rates, flight to quality, stable macro growth, right? So it's really talking about inflation and bond movements and how that's going to affect the market. And then the last couple pages here, pages six and seven, really just show you the yield curve movement. So we actually talked about that. So, you know, you come from basically earning nothing on your money on page six to earning almost 1.5% on your money, right? And that's like a one year move. And then you look at the next page, page seven, and this is just a 1 month move. And you see this yield curve moving. So a lot of movement here in the yield curve, a lot of pressure upward. And then increased interest rate risk and fixed income leads to potential volatility again. Page eight, why are we seeing this volatility in the market? Why are we seeing that? A lot of interest rate movement, you know, can lead to this volatility. And then page nine is what I showed you in your book, which basically says if you miss the best 10 days in the market, if you miss the best 20 days in the market, best 30 days in the market over the last 37 years, you know, what would happen? And I think that's a pretty stark contrast there. And then page 10 just shows you January. January was a straight line up. And then, of course, February, sort of a straight line down. So I think we're gonna see this year some increased volatility in this market. And that's basically it. But just, you know, people want to know about, you know, I always come in and I'm 2 months behind where the markets were. And so try to give you a little bit of an update of where we currently are.
Any further questions on markets? Oh. There being none, we'll move on to our attorney's report. Well, so far as good news, Cindy and I touched on this before the meeting. It looks like a session will adjourn beginning in March. It started early this year in January. It looks like we may come out unscathed again. Today, the only bill that has been pre-filed, it could have an impact of any kind on us. You know, it deals with actuarial assignments. It's a little more actuarial assignment on the little more. What did you say, Doug? A little more pressure on you guys for the expected rate of return for assumption purposes.
Get more of the assumption business.
Yeah, and it's got a lot of components to it procedurally, but I wouldn't recommend we get into the detail now because it may well not pass. If it passes, then we can go through the deals of it. I don't really think when it comes right down to it, it's going to make that much difference in what we're doing.
Yeah, at this point, committee meetings are pretty much over. The Senate and the House have both propped up in 87, voting on a budget. They don't match where the priorities are and the $87 million, of course. Sometimes the horse trading involves bills. I'll pass your budget measure if you attach this bill provision to it, and then we can go forward. So that's where that is right now. It's called the conference sessions. So we're moving towards those sessions. So that's for at least for the general plan actuarials that we will issue. There's some other stuff that would affect the fire and police plans, but that doesn't affect you guys.
Yeah, for the fire, you may recall
cancer presumption.
For 2 and 3 years ago, they introduced the cancer as an inline of duty presumption for disability. Did not pass either time. It's back again this time. I don't think it will pass again. There's also another bill which actually goes a little further, Senate Bill 900, which provides that if your plan doesn't insure for cancer, then the employer has to fund coverage for the employees for cancer. But again, that actually goes further than the other, so I don't think we're going to see those pass.
Yeah, it's 100% cancer presumption. Any cancer of any kind is automatically caused by your job. And no medical history required, no pre-existing condition concerns. And the cancer policies are 100% employer funded. So I'm like, really? Okay, so yeah, there's been a lot of pushback from the counties and the cities on that. It's like, look, we want our firefighters to be safe, and at the city, we take great exception because we provide life scan to our firefighters. So we're scanning their complete bodies for all illnesses, you know, every, you know, half 1 year, half the next year, you know. We open it up to their family if they want to pay the fee. Their family can go and get scanned. It also provides, that Citadel provides for some extension of those cancer benefits to their spouse. As if it's contagious, I was like, I don't even understand that. Probably because your spouse caught cancer from you. It also provides for a higher level disability pension, you know, if you go out for cancer. It provides for a minimum level of percentage of your pay that must be paid out to a firefighter if you retire under cancer. So just, you know, cost drivers to public plans. You know, we all love our fire guys and want them to be healthy and safe, but at the same time, you know, the taxpayers,
Florida's really come in the minority net with this, right? Most states have this already.
Yeah.
Accepted.
The reason I don't think that one's going to pass, as I mentioned, the last couple of years, just adding a presumptive inline of duty illness didn't pass, and this goes much further. So
other states accept just what Cindy was talking about?
Yeah, I think there's only probably like 5 or 6 states that don't have cancer presumption for firefighters. I mean, it's pretty much accepted nationwide.
Oh, on the police side. If you have any form of heart disease, it's automatically assumed that it's caused by your job. It has nothing to do with your lifestyle.
Right.
It's totally stress-related.
Right.
But, you know, again...
All of us are stressed.
Right. I don't know if that's the stress because I feel like money versus... But, you know, again, it just, you know, balancing that with the taxpayer and wanting to be responsible and good stewards of taxpayer dollars, you know, is a question, so.
Well, they automatically assume job related once you show total and permanent disability. That changes what we currently have and have had for a long time, which is a presumption that it's a rebuttable presumption.
Right.
So there can be evidence that it wouldn't apply. A lot of states have, and this would turn into a conclusive presumption, which would do what Cindy just said, that once you establish total and permanent disability, it's based on cancer, it's in line.
Right, regardless. So, you know, we just have to balance that with being fiscally responsible and, you know, what types of benefits are available in the plan and, you know, that kind of thing. So, I mean, I would rather personally do preventative things like we do for the firefighters here and wellness programs and things that would prevent illness versus just waiting and, you know, paying for them back then, because we know what the cost of medical care is.
Well, incidence-wise, over the years, we don't have as much cancer-based claims. It's more for orthopedic for a long time.
As far as
and the last thing for disability, for the last couple of years, PTSD is moving into the picture. So.
Mm-hmm. So stay tuned. The session ends all. We'll provide you guys a report out. But it is one of the horse tradable items for the budget. I will. Session ends on March 9th, Anthony. So funny. Anthony is alluding to the fact that I have resigned my post at the city. And this will be my last pension board, so he's being cute. Mm-hmm. Yes, my last day is March 23rd, which is so I will provide a report out on session because it ends March 9th. I'll give it to Alicia, and she can give it to you. Guys.
I'm trying to load her down before she gets
somewhere.
You will not run into me in another city somewhere. Nope, I am looking for a consulting firm. Consulting, so.
Because that happens in some cases. In fact, Diane, she's in Clyde City.
Yeah. Well, we'll miss you a lot.
Thank you. Yeah, it's been a long time. So I'm a short time as well.
I enjoyed working with you.
Thank you. Yeah, so it's been a great run. We've had some rough times we've pitched over the last 10 years, but it's been a good run. I appreciate it. But, city will have my replacement before I leave.
Yeah, right.
Thank you. Well, I gave them a couple months' notice. They've known, so. So that was my goal, giving them a couple months' notice that we could make that transition be smooth. So hopefully that will have some transparent.
Anything further from council?
No.
Moving on to our minutes from the last two meetings, which were distributed via email. Let's move to a motion on the August minutes. Do I have a motion to approve the August minutes?
I'll make a motion to approve this minutes.
We have a motion from Mr. Ortiz. Do we have a second?
I'll second.
We have a second from Mr. Walker. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes with regard to the November regular meeting. Do we have a motion to approve?
I'll make a motion to approve the minutes of the November.
Carol approves, makes the motion. Do we have a second?
Second.
We have a second from Mr. Ortiz. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Motion passes. The minutes for both meetings are approved. Other matters to come before the board. Approve the 2016-17 expenses and budget. I believe that is why Ms. Gator is here.
I am.
Not that she's not here other times, but
well, now that there's two of us, some of the fire board meetings are scheduled at the same time as the general board, so it makes it a little bit easier on them. We can work around Thanksgiving and stuff like that a little bit easier. So that is why I was not at the last meeting. Sorry. And and what I'm passing out here is the budget and the expenses. The expenses were for last year. The budget will be submitted in March of this year. When you look through it, it hasn't changed much. We added a little bit more money to retirees, because of course that is the line item that continues to go up. We don't have as much drop payout this year. We're only expecting one. It's a pretty big one, but it's the only one. Lee, correct me if I'm wrong. This board doesn't have to have a motion to approve them for the expenses.
No.
They just need to approve the budget.
Right, then file with the city. File with the city. One.
Yes. Police and fire have to do both by way of motion. If anybody has any questions about anything.
Did you get your laptop?
No, not yet. We're waiting to see about that. I was going to propose to each of the boards purchasing a laptop at a docking station so that we could use it for meetings. It would have recording abilities, so we could have options as to where we have our meetings. We are going to start a new financial system soon, and that's going to require a lot of overtime. And to be able to have the laptop would make that transition a lot easier.
When you say some options with regard to where we have our meetings, where we could start having them at Mark's and
we could. They have to be mostly just public.
No, but really, what?
But really, sometimes we use the finance conference room. We've used the budget conference room, and then there's a couple of conference rooms over at CSO and OPD.
And what you're saying is this room is set up.
Right.
But with a computer,
we could have external. From time to time, I use the clerk's laptop when it's available. And then
so
I
use external recording. Or you look.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. You are getting one though. We have to get it approved through the three boards, that kind of thing.
Then I thought we already had. Didn't we talk about it?
Well, I think you did talk about it at the last meeting, but the last meeting wasn't.
And I wasn't here.
Last meeting didn't count.
Okay. So.
All right.
So yeah, we talked about it. Reviewed something.
We talked about it.
Okay. we did not talk about it in the fire meeting because it wasn't supposed to. We barely even had a meeting. So,
okay.
And then police chose not to have a meeting. So each board did something different.
Do we have a proposal for this laptop? Or
it was there. I think we all approved it, but
at the last meeting.
That didn't count. Yeah.
Yeah.
That didn't count.
Didn't count. Apparently, a clerk didn't post the meeting, and they have to post.
So we have to. It has to be regurgitated. Is that it?
Exactly.
Where would that be? In these papers, in terms of.
Do you know the number? We could
list it from a prior meeting.
Our portion. It's not much.
No, it was like $400. Yeah. Under $400.
Don't even.
It was like $360 something. I didn't bring it with me. I didn't know.
Guidance.
Bernie, I think since the last meeting, it wasn't posted. I'd recommend you do a motion to approve.
All right, I'll make a motion.
Purchase of a computer with a dollar limitation to it, or what?
Yes.
And it has to have a certain dollar limitation, does it?
Well, you can say up to $500 or something like that. You know, it's.
I'll make a motion to contribute up to $500 for use of a laptop.
Do we have second that? I will second.
We have a second for Mr. Hirsch. All in favor?
Aye.
The motion passes. Any discussion with regard to pension trust fund revenues and expenses or the budget that's projected? Do Hearing none, we will move on to our next item, acceptance of the 2018 meeting dates. We all found our way here today, so I guess that one was accepted.
Yeah, sorry, my calendar got wiped. I see, at the finest.
And those things are...
Yeah, it wasn't on my calendar.
Yeah, I went over back on that.
No, it worked for me.
I had it.
Because when we came in, it wasn't working yet.
You know, I didn't remember that a lot of the way there.
Somebody had a lot of screw.
I was like, I know there's a new.
Yeah, I just knew because you sent me that email and said, hey, I'll see you on Monday for that travel conference.
So the other dates are May the 14th.
I will work on the calendar to make sure everyone, and if not, I'll just send out a second one. If you've got it, you can disregard it. If you don't, but I'll send out another outlook.
So we have May the 14th, August the 13th, and December the 10th. Do I hear an objection?
The dates work for me, so I'm good.
Hearing no objection, those dates are accepted, and the pension office will communicate that to everyone again.
Yes.
Would that be it, or is there something else that we need to chat about?
Sorry I'm late. Like I said, it wasn't my calendar. Did we discuss with Lee and... while we have everybody here about employees pre-designating their benefits if they happen to pass before they actually retire?
We hadn't talked about that.
So I probably mentioned that once before, and you gave some commentary and said we'd have to talk to Doug to see if we'd have to do. So we have a couple employees that if they pass before they retire, just 10 years, of their pension goes, even if they wanted to designate, you know, for the rest of their, at a lower rate, their spouse to get it for life or something. And we've never discussed that, but we know a few other cities do that. So I brought it up and I spoke about it, but...
Something we can do. It needs to be amended to our ordinance, but you're right. Some do it. Ours is the pre-retirement death benefit.
I know there aren't that many employees still in the old plan, but I'm still, you know, asking about it. Is there a cost to it, Doug?
No, we will anticipate whether somebody's going to pre-fill that out or not, so we just assume that death benefit's going to be payable to someone.
All right, I'm stepping aside from being his chair, since his chair's really not supposed to get involved in these. Just supposed to be a referee. I must have missed the meeting. Was it the November meeting that you talked about this?
Yeah.
What is it now, and
so now there's nothing. I mean,
nothing, meaning
so I as an employee cannot say that I want to sign that if I pass away next week my wife gets my pension the rest of her life. So automatically she'll get it for 10 years
by terms of the plan.
But yes, by the terms of the plan,
as a result of dying prior to
retirement,
but being fully vested in the plan.
Yes.
Right, yeah. Now, she just gets it 10 years.
Correct.
And the option we're talking about going to is?
Is at a reduced rate, she could have it for her life if I passed.
Which
there's eight different options when you retire that you can select of.
Yeah.
How you want to, you know.
And that's one of them, but that would probably be the survivor part of a joint survivor.
Correct.
And just give that option before retirement.
So what are the options now for employees when they retire? Can they
change
that pre-retirement? Can they continue to revisit that?
Pre-retirement, they can't make any elections.
Mm-hmm. Right now, they can't.
They can't.
Right.
The default is 10 years.
Okay.
He's saying give them the option to do the life pre-retirement. So instead of the default being 10 year, maybe it's not a default, you have to select, or maybe it will default unless you select survivorship.
And it would probably be a reduced amount.
Right.
But it would be payable.
You have to give them the option to select, because right now it's just a default.
Right.
Which would be an ordinance. change that we need to go to.
Yeah, there wouldn't be any cost because we would actuarially adjust the 10-year down to a life, so.
So we had a discussion, and of course, since the meeting didn't count anyway, I want to bring it back up, see if anyone else has any interest in it like I do.
The meeting didn't count, we didn't have a quorum?
We had a quorum, but the city clerk's office didn't post it for the public meeting, so.
So it never really happened?
Yeah.
What I missed?
Yeah.
You missed it?
We all just got together.
It didn't actually happen, we just got around.
Are you interested in a life annuity or total survivor, are those the options?
That's what I'm thinking.
And I brought it up to Arnie when I went to the Division of Retirement. Sarah was saying that in their plan and with others, that there is a pre-retirement. If someone comes to you and fills out a form before they pass out electing their option, we needed to honor that. And I said, well, I don't think that's in our plan like that. So.
Correct, because our ordinance states it's a default.
Right, setting. Default. Right. But if you've made the election prior to death, it's not a default because you've made an election.
But you only make the election upon planning retirement, right?
And you have an actual.
So right now we don't have the option to make that.
Right, that's when you're retiring, so that's not really beneficial if you're going to work 17 more years.
Or if you just, yeah.
Or if you're.
Right, but the plan was to see.
So the people want to say.
I mean, I think.
Yes.
Yeah. So we would just have to clean up or not, you know, amend our ordinance to, you know, make that the case.
It's not going to cost anything.
If it doesn't cost anything, I don't think anybody's going to.
All right. I couldn't support it.
Well, so now is the opportune time. I mean, since Doug is here and Lee is here, it's just a little.
Well, we determined there's not going to be any cost, but again, I guess I go back to.
Well, so there'd be a little bit of cost.
Yeah.
Right, we're going to have to have. Let's put it, the cost is not. Well, it is immediate.
Correct.
It's not an ongoing actuarial impact to the plan. Current liability.
So. When does a person make this election?
When they retire or go into drop, which is the same thing. You retire to go into the drop.
But not terminate.
Well,
you don't terminate until you leave your employment. Drop is a retirement. Okay. So this would only come about at such time as you retired, you would make this decision, but before you terminated from the city, that doesn't make any sense.
No.
Because you're locking in your benefits.
The point is, you can make this election at any time,
like today.
You get a hankering.
Okay.
That's the point. Right now, you can only make that election upon retirement.
Upon return. So I guess what I'm trying to say is, when would an employee be presented with this? Would he be presented with this when he becomes an employee of the city of Ocala?
Well, no, because people can't enter this plan. So
okay, we're talking about this plan.
Right. This is an ordinance change, and it is something that's completely voluntary. So if one of the 200 employees in the plan chooses to take this election, they'll be notified upon an ordinance.
I was going to say.
But if they don't do anything different, they don't do anything different. This
so
is
they'll still be the default.
They'll still be in the default unless they elect to go to do this. Because if they don't have a spouse.
And then I would think they could unelect.
I don't know, prior to
being dead.
Do you want to get into that?
I don't know if we want to start, you know, pick this, do that, change my
They're aiming to be here till retirement. You know, they're aiming to be here till retirement.
So if you take that, the only life altering is if you divorce.
Right.
Right? Or if your wife passes during that period.
Well, but the statute takes care of that situation, doesn't it? In terms of if you divorce.
No, that's not your divorce decree.
So Bernie, I've seen a few cases where somebody gets divorced and they forget to get
change their benefits.
Yes, we've had those situations here at the city a couple of times.
Well, now the statute voids that.
Right. That's voided now by statute. That's what I was alluding to.
Yeah.
But I guess what I'm trying to say is, so if we change the ordinance, now all of a sudden a person. It's in the general employee's plan, which is a closed plan. Nobody's coming into it anymore. They have the option to take this
pre...
Retirement.
Retirement. Okay, they're still breathing, and they can make this decision. Now, if they're still breathing when they retire, I would think they could say...
Never mind.
Never mind.
Now I don't want my trust to get my money. Yes.
Yeah. So that's the way you can do the paperwork, right?
Yeah.
So if I'm completing the paperwork, yeah, they can change it.
Conservative. So, I take it we need a box.
People change their beneficiaries while they're employed all the time, so. I mean, it would pretty be the same. Just a different piece of paper.
So we need a motion.
The mouthful.
And it would seem that the motion would be to amend the ordinance with regard to an election that could be made pre-retirement.
That would apply in a pre-retirement death situation.
Pension disability.
Other than the default, which is now in the plan, if death occurs before retirement, that, or that we even have to say that.
I mean, if somebody made this election, the default wouldn't come into play. Yeah.
And that would be...
It's a mouthful.
Yeah. Since you seem, and you're over there, so Arnie, you could clearly make this motion since you're familiar with it.
Guidance on the verbiage?
Yeah, it's just to... amended the ordinance, an opportunity to select an optional form of benefit for a pre-retirement death situation. And then just decide what the same options that you have upon retirement, or if you just want to be limited to life annuity and go to survivor, we'll put that in there. We can do either one. What do you think, Mark?
I think it's just pre-retirement, and then when you retire, if you want to correct it, you correct it.
Yeah, then the options you have to choose pre-retirement would be life annuity and joint survivor.
Right.
And so we wouldn't, in Social Security now, we have no reason to include that. Right?
Yeah.
So that's what we're talking about, is just having a life annuity option or joint survivor. Right?
Correct.
Do we have a motion?
We have a motion. Without repeating it, is it good enough? Can we go with that? Okay, all right.
I'll try to not be so verbose in the ordinance.
We don't want it to depart from... Do we have a second to the motion?
I'll second it.
We have a second from Ms. Carroll. All in favor, aye.
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 Okay, I'll do a draft of that and bring it back. Maybe you will look at it.
Thank you.
And move forward.
Is there any further business? Being no further business, I will entertain a motion to adjourn.
Motion to adjourn.
We have a motion to adjourn. Do we have a second?
Second.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
That was wonderful.
Pardon?